Tape number 2, Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History number 2. I am Mildred Menlo, and with my partner, Ruth Weiner, we are interviewing Jane Arkus.
Mrs. Arkus, as I looked over the notes, there were some things that I wasn't clear about, and I wondered if we could clarify that. For example, starting back at the beginning, about your father. You told me he was chief of internal medicine. That was where?
He was chief of medicine at Allegheny General Hospital and also at Montefiore Hospital. At one time, he was chief at both hospitals at the same time, and then there was some overlapping. Then I believe is his term at Montefiore ended, and he continued to be chief at Allegheny General.
Tell us more about him.
He was a very wise and gentle man of considerable learning, great compassion for people, a man of high integrity and standards who was certainly a guiding light in his own family and to his patients, who to this day still approach me, and he's been dead for some 10 years, still approach me and tell me how much they revered my father and with what affection they regarded him, and how much of an empty space it's left in their lives, as patients as well as friends, to have him gone.
It is rare for patients to feel that kind of relationship.
Well, I think perhaps the doctor-patient relationship overall was a little different at that time. Although the doctor's life was certainly not without pressure, I think that the business of medicine, and I put that in quotes, had not become such a business, and there seemed to be a great deal more personal attention given to the whole human being than seems to be happening now.
Unfortunately. In talking about your mother, I wasn't quite clear about her name.
Florence Schoenthal. Florence Madeline Schoenthal.
And somewhere along the line, I got confused between the Schoenthals and the Silvermans.
Oh,
would you clarify?
Yes. My mother's mother was a Silverman, and they were from Pittsburgh. And I wish I could fill in with more about them, but some of what I did learn has escaped my brain. And my mother's father, Lee Schoenthal, was from Little Washington. My mother was from New York, as I think I told you.
Mm-hmm.
But Lee Schoenthal, shortly after my mother was born in Little Washington, Washington, PA, scooped the family up and took them to New York, where he was the head of china and glass imports for the Gimbel's chain. And therefore, my mother grew up in New York, came back to Pittsburgh to marry when one of her cousins introduced her to my father. And I think I did mention that, because I think I mentioned that this woman, Tilly Spire, who
yes.
was also the one who introduced my husband to me.
Yes. You said your mother had studied art. Tell me more about that, what she did with it. And
she had some native talent, and she traveled with her father a great deal in Europe when he went over on buying trips, and took advantage of being in Paris and the enormous resources for a young art student there to go to the École des Beaux-Arts and study for 1 or 2 years. I believe that after her that when she returned to New York, I believe that she worked professionally copying, using her ability to illustrate, copying from Fifth Avenue department store windows, styles, current styles that could then be knocked down, as they said, by some of the mass manufacturers on 7th Avenue. So, but since then she has, from time to time, done drawing and painting for the fun of it.
Can you tell me anything about your mother's siblings?
My mother was an only child. My father had brothers.
If you mentioned them, but didn't tell us anything about them.
He had a brother, Clarence, who died some years ago in an automobile accident. But he was an engineer who moved to California early in his career. I don't remember for whom he worked out there, but I just remember that my Uncle Cal was at the other end of the country and that I saw him very rarely as a kid. My uncle Irvin, my father's other brother, settled in Cleveland. He was married a couple of times, pardon me, three times. His first wife died. His second wife, he was divorced from her, and his third wife, a Catholic woman, he married in Cleveland, and they've had a very long and happy marriage. And produced a bunch of children, and they now have a lot of grandchildren. And he's still going strong and going to work a couple of times a week at age 92.
Doing what?
He has been in the in a car dealership for many, many years. I think from about midlife on, he has been very successful in a succession of dealerships, and has been written up, I think, as one of the wonders of the world in Cleveland, this man who refuses to stop working, and whose employers still want him present, because he's evidently a master salesman, and still enjoys the loyalty of his old customers. But he's quite a remarkable man, a very active mason, Shriner. Totally different from my father in his way of life, social interests. My father tended to be scholarly, a lover of classical music, a rather introverted and quiet man. My Uncle Irvin is totally outgoing, hail fellow, well-met, classic Shriner. Sans the boisterousness, I guess, but he's a glad-handing fellow.
Great. like to know a man like that. It's
part of his success.
Yes, oh indeed.
You talked a little bit too about your life at Vassar, but didn't tell us too much about your courses and what you studied.
Oh, I was an experiment among a very few women who were allowed to pursue an interdisciplinary major. I discovered that while I had a keen interest in English and literature, that I wanted to apply some small writing skills to some sort of calling that would demand writing skills to persuade, propaganda, advertising. I wasn't sure what I wanted to be, but I knew that I wanted to use words to persuade people. And so I was very much interested also in courses in sociology. I was interested in society, and they allowed me to do a cross major of English and social sciences, and with a history of art thrown in, because I was very much interested in visual expression. What that resulted in was a senior thesis which combined illustration with prose. It was an educational propagandistic piece that had to do with the prejudices primarily in the context of racial, religious, the prejudices we hold and how we and why, and it was directed at young people. That was my senior thesis, which was later on exhibited at the college among a few other senior theses that were the product of interdisciplinary majors. Had a very good and rich college experience from the standpoint of the academics. I at first felt a little lost at Vassar because while I had been at near the top of my class at Winchester, I was thrown in with a lot of girls who had come from exactly the same kind of background of achievement at their schools, and was just, you know, one of a sea of achievers. But I did feel challenged there, very much so. Found that I could pursue some interests in leadership roles on campus that were satisfying to me. I was cartoonist of for the Vassar Miscellaneous News, among some other cartoonists, and then art editor of the senior yearbook, and participated in college extracurricular dramatic functions. My life centered during the week very much in academics. We were a women's college, and it was a wonderful opportunity that I value very much, as I did my prep school training. It was a wonderful opportunity in a non-competitive, that is non-competitive with men, environment to learn who I was and what I could do. The men came into my life on the weekend, and I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Although the religious the barriers were down in classes during the week, and I had many non-Jewish friends at college, on the weekends the barriers went up again, and the Jewish girls tended to come together for dating. We moved in our own tight circle, and my non-Jewish friends moved in their own social circles, and never the twain met.
When you were in college, were you a political activist?
Not particularly. Certainly, politics entered into our lives in that we were very hyper aware of what was going on in the world. It was the kind of environment that encouraged you to be very much aware of what was going on in the world, and we certainly discussed it. But I remember at the time there was a very activist faction at the college who were running around with guitars and singing about Henry Wallace. And I came from a family who were rather conservative in their political beliefs, and tended, I guess I was daddy's little girl for a long time before I decided who I was and what I believed in. When I came home from college, shortly after I came home from college, I believe it was the year of the Eisenhower-Stevenson election, and I think I was temporarily ostracized from most of my friends because my father talked me into voting for Eisenhower, and that certainly made an oddball of me. He was philosophically disposed towards Stevenson, but really felt that, you recall, it was the time for a change year, and there was a sense that the nation needed the firm hand of a tried and true leader, and my father was very much afraid that if Stevenson became president, that his feet would be firmly implanted in midair, because he was such a liberal in a true sense of the word. He saw all sides of all issues. As it turned out, I think my father was right, but it was unusual that I should, that in my crowd of post-college, it was unusual to vote Republican. Vassar should have radicalized me more, considering the environment.
Was it? I always think of it as being fairly conservative.
Oh, but it, no, I think the strong faculty that I was exposed to were all very liberal, and I considered myself a liberal. I was just buying some very good arguments, I thought, on the part of a very liberal conservative, my father.
It just seems that every generation has to buy something.
Yes. Make a statement of its own. I became more politically liberal later on. Never changed my party affiliation out of some weird mystical sense of loyalty, but have voted Democratic most of the time ever since.
Interesting. I adored my father, but he was Republican. I went right down and registered as a Democrat.
Right.
We always thought the two of us should stay home on election day.
Oh, we argued a great deal. Of course, my father thought Leon was the radical because he had been very much involved in the 30s in the listening certainly to those who were promoting the socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody and all the young people in New York went through that phase.
Where were you during the Depression years?
I was growing up in Pittsburgh in Squirrel Hill.
Lived in Squirrel Hill?
We lived on Bennington Avenue, which was a relatively new street when we moved in. Or rather, our block on the street was relatively new. They were plowing a field and laying foundations. We moved from Moorwood Gardens, where I lived for the first 3 years of my life, to Squirrel Hill. And I stayed there until I got my own apartment, which was somewhat late in life for a woman to be moving into her own apartment. I was close to 40, but I had had a very, very pleasant deal at home, getting good meals, served free, and without putting in much work.
Did you find that your neighborhood, as such, had any economic, cultural, or political influence?
Well, it was certainly it was an upper middle class, in the upper socioeconomic, on the upper socioeconomic scale. Actually, it was a neighborhood of mixed Jews and non-Jews. And Bennington, the other part of Bennington, we lived in the last block towards Oakland, but the upper part of Bennington was a very affluent neighborhood that had members of some of the Pittsburgh establishment families living on it. So I met some of those kids in my youth. As I said, one branch of the Mellon family was there. The Isley family of Klondike fame was there. We had wonderful Halloweens in our neighborhood because the Isleys gave out Klondikes, and there were a few other prominent families who were prominent merchants who had goodies to give out too, and their names escape me. Cordelia Scaife, little Cordelia Scaife lived around the corner. Moreland. Mrs. Raymond Moreland lived on the corner. But our block was predominantly, except for one corner house, was predominantly Jewish. The Falks lived opposite us on the other side of the street. And as I told you, Ellen was my best friend growing up, and we had a nice little crowd of kids on Bennington Avenue.
Well, she's living in Kitty's house in Israel now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. During the wars, Korean War, World War II, Vietnam War, mm-hmm. did you have any involvement in anything?
regarding those.
You mean an activist?
Civil rights movements or anything of that sort.
I was involved in some political campaigns, professionally as well as on a non-professional basis. On the local level, I was involved in 1969. It was earlier than 69. And early in the 60s, I was involved in John Tabor's campaign for mayor in Pittsburgh. Subsequently, I was involved professionally. Strike that. I was involved in John Tabor's campaign for city council in the early 60s. He represented liberal republicanism, and the Republican Party at that time was trying very hard to get some representation in this solid rock Democratic bastion called council called Pittsburgh.
Too.
And he was a very good man,
yes,
and I felt I was fond of him, and I was fond of his supporters, and they corralled me into the cause, and I worked very hard for him. Then later on, in 1969, when he ran for mayor, I was part of an agency that was that competed to handle the John Tabor campaign for mayor. The Republican National Committee pumped a lot of money into that campaign, and the local Republican establishment, and we were chosen to handle that campaign. And I was the creative director at the time. It was a fascinating part of my brief career in politics. We lost for a lot of reasons, as you know.
With whom did you work?
In the
campaign.
In the campaign. I worked directly for a very interesting man who was designated our overseer from the Republican National Committee. He was a one of the best known of the, at that time, of the communications consultants in politics. His name was Harry Trelevan, and he had been a senior vice president at J. Walter Thompson, who was caught up in a political mission and subsequently spent his full time in politics.
What's his name again?
Trelevan. And he was the one who chose us to work on the campaign, and he said largely because of the creative work I had done in the presentation. So he became a kind of mentor to me for a while. I thought I was in love with him, too. But it was as a result of that connection, we were asked whether we would be interested subsequently in working, since I was a woman, for the Lenore Romney campaign for Senate in Michigan, which is how I happened to have gotten involved in the United States senatorial campaign, which also was doomed, like Tabor's campaign, from the start. The Romneys didn't have a chance of breaking through Philip Hart's stronghold on the job, and truth to tell, had I been simply a Michigander voter, I would have voted for Hart. But I liked the Romneys, and there was nothing, I felt that I was in a sort of professional position of a lawyer. I liked the Romneys. They stood for good things. There was nothing about their political stance that was incompatible with my beliefs, and I couldn't resist the opportunity to get involved with the excitement of a national level campaign. So I spent a year doing that. It was before I was married, traveling around the country, interviewing people like a congressman named Gerald Ford. And,
wonderful.
They sent me to Washington, and I made a documentary film about Lenore for the campaign, and was sent all over the country to Washington to interview Ford and John Tower and Hugh Scott, and talked to George Romney and about strategy with some trepidation. I'm just a little girl, and I'm going up to the director of HUD to tell him why he should be doing what we were recommended he should be doing for his wife. Went out to Hollywood to interview Bob Hope and Art Linkletter, who were casting their endorsements Lenore's way. I got to know her very well, a wonderful woman, a bright and kind and compassionate woman who I think was quite uncomfortable about running for the Senate. She was thrust into that position because they thought that she could accomplish one thing, and that is to hold on to the Romney's political base in Michigan. And we were not supposed to win. We were told that our objective was to get 35% of the vote, and we did. It's interesting, as a result of that, I met fabled Max Fisher, who was...
I knew Max.
You knew Max Fisher. Well, philanthropist, Jewish philanthropist, and a great political supporter of the Romneys, and he had a lot of money behind that campaign, so I spent some time with some of the backers, too, showing our wares and begging for money, and that was an interesting perk of the job. So there was another political campaign. The work on that campaign was I was proud of. We got 35% of the vote. The New York Times made some nice comments about the political documentary and said that of its genre, they thought it was one of the better pieces of propaganda. So I guess I was really doing in this business what I wanted to do, which was use whatever talents I had as a writer to become a communications person in behalf of some good causes.
Currently.
What am I doing now? Well, I just came back from the Pittsburgh Trust for Cultural Resources, where I serve on the board, but I've also been engaged as a consultant in the marketing of cultural tourism in Pittsburgh. And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to apply what I do to some keen interests, one of which is to help make Pittsburgh a prime center for the performing arts and also help Pittsburgh become economically revitalized.
Well, how have they avoided doing a theater in Pittsburgh to replace the old Nixon?
Oh, now you bring up another subject. You asked if I was an activist. I was not so much an activist politically, but I sure was an activist to save the Nixon and not do away with the one legitimate theater in this town that we can bring. What's happening now, you may have heard, there are, because it's been afloat, although it's not a fait accompli yet. We're waiting for some funding and for some key decisions, but the Pittsburgh Trust is very seriously looking at buying the Fulton Theater. It happens to be, the Fulton was built not as a movie house. It was built as a legitimate theater, and it happens to be a facility that our New York consultants say is ideally suited to become Pittsburgh's prime legitimate theater.
Large.
And at far lower cost than it would be to start from scratch.
I was there last night.
Oh,
see Babette's Feast.
Oh, isn't it wonderful?
Oh, I love it.
I adored it too.
I don't go to theater here.
Well, you want to try the City Theater?
I go to last night we saw Three Rivers.
Shakespeare Festival.
It wasn't Shakespeare, it was Johnson, and they about it.
It was Volpone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you had asked me, I would have told you that.
Volpone.
The cast was marvelous, but the play should have been left buried.
Yes, that's what I heard.
But acoustically, there is no place here for theater, for intimate theater.
You're absolutely right.
And so I just don't go.
No,
unless
Macbeth
I go to, you know, as you say, City Theater, or the Shakespeare Festival, mm-hmm. Carnegie.
Yes, we
go to
the
Pitt when they have theirs, but that's all.
I've been working on the borders.
So they might take the Fulton.
Yes, that's very much in the works. As I said, it's not a fait accompli yet, but...
that would be marvelous.
Well, what our objective is to create a critical mass of performing facilities and performance programs in the downtown area that will start to build a performance habit not only for people who live in Pittsburgh and a habit of attending performance, not only for people who live in Pittsburgh, but for people in surrounding regions. The goal is to make Pittsburgh the regional prime performing arts center.
It has the drawing.
Yes, and to have a constant influx of good programming. Bring the best of the world's theater and dance and music to Pittsburgh along with our resident companies. And
I think after the Macbeth fiasco here, they realized they need it.
Absolutely. Although it was in the works, we knew at the time that the Benedum was not ideal for Macbeth, but it was the only place that it could be put. No, I was part of a group of people who worked long and hard and wrote some major proposals and went around to the foundations in town to preserve the Nixon. It was a movement called Theater Yes.
End of side one, tape two, continued on side two.